Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta to Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta to Yankee, Delta to Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Chemical process. 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 Chemical process.
Handmade tools.
Chemical process.
Give a really good edge to the tool. Described as being against the grain.
Chemical process.
Cut the pieces.
Got a feeling for the material.
Chemical it's process.
Along the length of the tree.
The first thing that I would do is I would knead what's known as wedge my clay up, so to get it consistent, because as it's been sitting around for a while in the studio, the outside may dry a little bit more than the inside, and if I then put it on the potter's wheel, I would get these kind of stiff bits and it would make the pieces really quite hard to make. So the first thing I would do was knead that up, and in a perfect world I would have a concrete bench to do that, but in here I need to use the floor because I haven't got a solid enough work station at the moment. At that point, once I've done the kneading, which takes 5-10 minutes, I would then divide the clay up, weigh it up, and then use those weighed lumps on the wheel to produce pots of various sizes. So I've got an electric wheel, which is quite noisy. Yeah, and so once I've made the piece, I use a lot of metal tools in my making. So there's a lot of scraping. I use a lot of metal tools, there's quite a lot of handmade tools in here, I guess, as well. So I've got those for helping me shape and cut the pieces. And quite often I throw the pieces and get them to a point where they begin to collapse. And to stop them from actually collapsing, I use a heat gun on them. So that I use for 5-10 minutes a piece. Quite often I'll continue throwing once I've kind of got them dry enough to be able to hold their own again. And once the pieces have been made, they come off the wheel, I allow them to dry out to the point where they kind of have the consistency of leather, so they're a bit movable, but they're not completely stiff, but they're a lot stronger than they are when they're really soft. And then I cover them in a white clay ground. It's a bit like priming a canvas, really. So I use terracotta brick clay. I use that because of the way that my work's developed. It's partly to do with the fact that there was a tradition of making in red clay and then grounding it with white in North Devon. Pots from North Devon traditionally made that way, I guess, about 200-300 years ago, were transported to America. There was a project, an American-funded project, where they were tracing the migration of people, apparently, according to the designs that they were finding, the designs that were made around Biddeford and Barnstaple, which are the predominant producers of this, what's known as North Devon slipware. So that was kind of because it's a tradition that comes comes from the area which I live. It was kind of a start point, really. So I use this white clay ground, pour that over the piece. That reintroduces moisture into the pieces and they start becoming soft again. So quite often I have to use the heat gun on them at that point. Once I get them back to leather hard, I then decorate with various coloured clays and underglazed prints which come out on the tissue. And I apply those with a brush so that I have a lot of Chinese brushes that I use. While I was doing my MA, I won a travel scholarship to go to China. I used that money to go to China. And while I was there, I discovered this underglazing technique, which I think it's known as a Japanese technique. It's used quite a lot in the East, and I don't know anyone that uses it here in the form that they use it there. So I use a lot of, I use this Japanese technique, I use a lot of Chinese brushes, I find them just really work well with the coloured clay. They hold a lot of material, so I'm able to brush a lot of material at once without having to keep going back to the pot, which means I get some nice fluid marks on the pieces in there. I build up layers of colour and print to a point where I'm kind of satisfied that I've got quite a rich surface, at which point the piece is dry, then they go in the kiln, come out low-fired, and apply some glaze quite loosely, again with Chinese brushes, go back into the kiln, they're fired again. At that point, quite often when I get them out of the kiln, I'll angle grind them to abrade the surface and pull some of the glaze off, and it tends to come off where the prints are sitting because they create a bad bond between the glaze and the clay, having these prints in between. So I get these kind of, the prints start coming back through the surface of the glaze, at which point I'll fire them again because I've scratched the hell out of it with the angle grinder, just to sort of smooth off the surface. And then at that point, if the pieces survive, feel that they need further enrichment, and this is something I'm developing more now. I'll then use like an overglaze enamel print, which comes out in a kind of plastic film, a little bit like those tattoos you get from bubblegum when you're a kid, a bit like that. You apply those at that point, and they go back into the kiln and they go get fired, low firing one last time before coming out. So there's quite a lot of processes, really.
Good sharp knife.
If the tool works, then that's good enough. Got myself a Black & Decker lathe attachment.
Knitting and spinning and spinning.
Nice fluid marks on.
Put that feldspar and the quartz.
Robinia pseudo acacia.
Scratching and cutting.
Scrounge into tips for chair legs and table legs.
Okay, so my raw material is wool and pretty much nothing else. And there are two ways of making felt. There's the ancient nomadic craft of felt making, which employs water and friction, and the friction you apply physically with your own body by rolling it or rubbing it. And the other process is a more modern technique called needle felting. And so you can either cajole loose wool fibres into a form, a three-dimensional form or a two-dimensional form, by using needle felting needles which are barbed down their shanks, and they basically just tangle the fibres. You repeatedly stab into the wool and it just tangles it, so it becomes a mat. But you can also, so in my case, I have the felt made on a massive loom in a huge mill on an industrial scale. So I have the felt made for me mechanically, and I can cut pieces of felt off and needle into them. So I can cut a sheet of felt and create a picture by needling other pieces of cut felt into them, or yarn. So it's almost like a sort of embroidery.
Shells and shells of dried out ball blanks.
Split willow and split brambles.
Terracotta, brick clay. I guess I go into
thin
some kind of
porcelain slug.
Throwing, pulling the clay up. Almost, well, not really that. You know, turning tools for carving into the clay.
A very beautiful wood.
Wedge my clay up.
A whole process.
The wooden wrapping iron. Wrapping iron?
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost. Well, I'm not really that. You know, I talk to myself a lot.
Embroidery.
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost. Well, I'm not really that. You know, I talk to myself a lot.
Embroidery. Embroidery. Embroidery.
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost. Well, I'm not really that. You know, I talk to myself a lot.
I think there are very few people who actually are involved in a whole process. I go out and buy the trees, I have them cut up.
I go into some kind
prepare the wood, I make the items, I pack them up and I send them to a shop.
Well, not really that.
The only thing I don't do now is the accountancy side, which is my partner's taken over. So most people's working lives are spent doing one particular process in a whole big process. In fact, I think most people's lives now are spent in front of computer screens, which of course I do a bit of, but
I guess I go into
it's much more constructive than that. It's very satisfying to actually make
sort
objects.
Of meditative state almost, where I'm not really that, you know, I talk to myself a lot. Rubber kidneys.
There's a dust extractor which takes the dust away.
Electric wheel.
Every hour in the workshop.
Cut the pieces.
Barium carbonate.
Burr oak.
A wooden wrapping iron, because it's boxwood, so it's quite heavy. You need something slightly heavy to compact the weave. Usually you use a metal one, but the metal one tends to pull the bark off, so I like to use the wooden one. Now I'm reading up the sides, using one rubber at a time, one weaver at a time, getting round and round. Constantly adjusting, making sure that everything is vertical, and that you're watching the spacing all the time. On this basket, the sides are sloping in, making something like that. So I've got them tied up fairly tightly. Fairly fast if you want to make a living at it. The side weaving is probably the quickest bit. So once you've got everything set up, it's quite quick. It's not a fast craft, I wouldn't say. In the old days they did used to make 8 to 10 baskets a day, but they were very, very, they employed a lot of, well, I would call them shortcuts in a way. They weren't looking for huge quality in the finish. You know, they were making baskets for, be just used in the field or used in the boats, and they had to be strong, but they weren't regarding them as perhaps in the same way that we look at them now.
Chinese brushes on consistency of leather.
Every hour in the workshop. Thank you.
they're level, you can keep them level if you're clever. Once they've gone out of true, they get dipped. In fact, what happens is the lower stone, the one underneath, becomes convex, and the one above becomes concave, funnily enough. So you have to swap them over every now and again and keep checking the thickness. And once they're out, it can take a lot of work to get them even. They're not really quarried anymore. They were quarried mainly, the main source was two quarries in Bavaria. Solnhofen was the famous one, which is actually where they found the Archaeopteryx skeleton, you know, which is a science museum. Well, it's one of these things that they are quite sought after, so people will pay quite a lot. But on the other hand, I mean, up till fairly recent, you could often find them, because this they were used commercially as recently as, well, in this country, I would say 20, 30 years ago, they were still, that was the time when printers, old-fashioned printers, were throwing them out. They were used for printing labels and things, and you'd multiply up a label on a stone and kind of, you still find them with old labels, cheese labels and whatever printed on them. Right, so what, yeah. This was a freshly ground stone, and I've just been making some drawing on it in different ways, using different crayons and different kind of greasy inks and stuff called touche. A lot of, in artist printmaking, a lot of French words, because you know, the French were such great printmakers in the 19th, 20th century. Anyway, touche is a kind of emulsion of wax and soap and stuff that is used to make these thin, kind of washy qualities here. So that's been drawn on and it's been scratched into, which is a nice thing you can do. You can scratch a mark through there. It's very versatile medium, and you wouldn't do this on a metal plate. That's what's nice about it. It's much more organic, and you can change things, and you can recover things. The metal plate lithography, what you put on tends to be what's there. So the stone is, yeah, there's something very attractive about it. But
every hour in the workshop.
Okay, scratch out the mark through there. Terminology in the tools.
Now they're all slab bed. So what you do is you, from lump of big lump of clay, you slice like a thin porcelain slab. Then you fold. It's like as if you're using paper, just cut up and then join together with some strips. That's how I make like different shapes. So I don't usually use wheels. And yeah, so good thing about slab build, every part of pot is same thickness. So you can make very, very light pot, especially teapot. It should be very light. The problem of porcelain glaze, unless you put very thick glaze on, you can't get good blue, which I'm hoping to get. So although the pot itself is light, after glazing, it's become very heavy. Well, that's not nothing I can do. So first of all, so-called biscuit kiln, which temperature goes up to like 1,000 degrees to just get ready for glaze, because glaze itself is just a kind of a ground stone material, like potash, feldspar, quartz, and some other materials. So basically it's nothing sticks to clay. So pot has to be completely dry in order to put glaze on. Otherwise glaze will run down because clay body is wet. So that's why I do biscuit fire. Most people does biscuit firing. Then put glaze on. I usually use sprayer and spray booth. The reason is the porcelain, this blue glaze, quite thick. It comes out blue. I mean, much thicker blue. So thin, getting very whiter. So if you use brush, say, you can see the mark of the brush mark, which is very distracting. So that's the reason I got this sprayer.
Every hour in the workshop. Every hour in the workshop. Every hour in the workshop.
That thing about repetition that I just keep finding in
every
so
hour
many
in the
bits
workshop
of my life. That thing about repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life. That thing about repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life. About repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.